And the second part of this morning is from Kurt Austin on the use of superluminality in dispersive pulse, propagation.
That goes like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that good? Or should I put it on my belt going up?
Going down is better because then gravity holds it.
Okay.
Let me just put it on your
belt. Okay. Yep.
If you don't mind.
I told you I'm a theoretician. This is far too experimental for me, just putting on the microphone.
Oh, we have boost too.
Yeah, there we go. Well, yeah. So I've been an absorber now, pretty much an absorber for a week and a half, with a few spontaneous emissions, and now I get to they were partially stimulated, but they were spontaneous in a sense, and then I get to emit now. And this should make my daughter happy, because she was horrified when she asked me about my talk if I was going to start it off with a joke, and I said no. And she said, "Oh, they are always taught you start your talk off by a joke." But I do think this is a good conference, because this is a great conference, and it should have received more press. About 10 years ago, I remember seeing something about what regular people think about science, and they think that scientists are studying the wrong problems. You know, the things they should be studying are time travel, invisibility, things like that. So this is getting there, I think. So, okay, no one does work alone, and I'm glad I don't, because I'm not sure where I would even be. I have a lot of collaborators on this problem. The problem actually comes originally from my dissertation at the Institute of Optics at Rochester. I certainly must thank my co-author on many, many of my papers, George Sherman, who's now, I put in quotes, retired. I'm not sure what retired means. He does teach still at a community college down in Los Angeles, but he actually used to teach at the Santa Barbara City College for a while also, but he's basically retired to Southern California and keeps on encouraging me not to do any more research. He says, "I've done enough. I should retire soon." So. Yeah, and my wife thinks there's a lot of wisdom in that advice, actually. And of course, Emil Wolf, who's given me, I've talked about this problem a great length over the years with Emil, and Carlos Stroud, who actually, when George left Rochester, Carlos became my dissertation advisor, I guess, while George stayed on as my research advisor. But there's since then, I've had a large number of collaborators. When I was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, I had a very good, very good master's degree student, Xupin Shen, who did a lot of work on multiple resonance Lorentz model dielectrics, came up with conditions for the appearance of new precursors, generalized the energy velocity to a multiple resonance Lorentz model dielectric. And then at University of Vermont, I've had a group of students, Judy Lawrence, who looked at the Debye model plus Lorentz model dielectrics. Paul Smith, who looked at this heat and energy loss in a lossy material, and it was appropriate for him to do that because his father is actually one of the co-inventors of the microwave oven. He's one of the guys that was sitting there at that lunch when they were tuning their microwave circuit, and they broke for lunch, and at that Raytheon, they took out their lunch bag, and the Hershey bar was melted. He was in on that Hershey bar, and they said, "Oh, I can cook. We can cook." And his mother actually wrote the first cookbook for the radar range. So, which is interesting. And I had a Kostas Bilixis did some very nice work on, which I'll talk about near the end of my talk, on Gaussian pulses. We have a description that describes Gaussian pulses of arbitrary width in a Lorentz model dielectric. Hong Zhao looked at the group velocity approximation, which is something that's always bothered me. And my current graduate student, Natalie Cartwright, she's getting her PhD in mathematics. But to help her understand the problem, I put her onto this thing on pulse velocities. It's a good thing to start thinking about. But she's going to be doing some transitional asymptotics for me, which I need. And also, when I was on sabbatical, I did some work with Jakob Stamnes and Jostein of Solhaug on these transitional asymptotic expansions, and also some stuff on pulse focusing. And also, must give, my research has been supported for 15 years by the Air Force, and it's always very good to have a good grant monitor. And Richard Albanese, I couldn't ask for a better predator monitor, and he's very interested in these pulse effects in biological systems and also in remote material identification. And once you see the properties of a Brillouin precursor, you'll understand why the Air Force, without even me having to explain why they're so interested in these problems. Anyhow, this theory is very old. It goes back into the early part of the last century. And my wife and I are upset that we were born in the first half of the last century, so we were just thinking about that, what that means. And the problem is there's a very fundamental problem by Sommerfeld and Brillouin in 1914 who wanted to answer the question, what's wrong with the group velocity? What is the velocity of a pulse in a dispersive material? And they provided the first proof that an electromagnetic signal could not propagate faster than the vacuum speed of light in a causal dielectric. And basically, I don't know why the problem separated this way. I'm sure they were co-authors on each other's papers, but Sommerfeld basically they broke the problem up into two pieces. There's the speed of light point. Sommerfeld treated to the left of that point, up to that point, and he had this beautiful proof that the field identically vanished, and he obtained expressions for what the turn on of the field would look like right at that space-time point, right at that speed of that luminal point. And then Brillouin took the rest of the problem. This is actually reproduced from their book. There are these first forerunners, these second forerunners, and the arrival of the signal. Sommerfeld's proof was rigorous. He was able to get a rigorous proof to show that the field identically vanished as long as the field itself, the initial field, vanished. Brillouin used some approximation techniques, which unfortunately he looked at saddle point dynamics, and he obtained saddle point dynamics, for example, for this first forerunner. The saddle point dynamics were only good near the front of the signal, but near the front of the signal, those saddle points were close to infinity, and the saddle point techniques that he was using break down in that region. So his asymptotics actually hold actually almost nowhere in that regime. And his asymptotics for the second forerunners only hold around one very, very short space-time point in the neighborhood of that space-time point. Yes, there is. Yeah, there is some earlier stuff, right? And also the question that Brillouin really wanted to ask and tried to answer is when do you define the arrival of the signal? And I'll get it. And that's something I'm going to get into on this. And it's important to remember that. The approach that they took, they looked at a Heaviside unit step function signal, and the approach that George and I have taken over the years has been a canonical approach, is not to try to answer the question in general, define a signal velocity in general, but to look at different types of canonical problems and to ask in detail what's going on in that pulse. And that's kind of what we focused ourselves on, and you'll see that in this paper. Now I'm going backwards. Okay, so here's the first thing. There's what I call this Sommerfeld's relativistic causality theorem. I'm not sure what some people just call it, Sommerfeld's theorem, but there's lots of Sommerfelds. He did a lot of work in a lot of different things. But basically, it says that here you have this problem where you know the field on the plane z equals z naught. You want to know the field in the positive half space, for example. It satisfies. You have this spectral component of the wave. This could be the E field, the B field, or the optical field, but it satisfies this Helmholtz equation. K tilde is a complex wave number, omega over C times n of omega. N of omega is a complex index of refraction. This is the spectrum of my initial field. A of 0 and T is F of T. That's where I get this F tilde of omega. Here is my propagated field. I can write it two different ways. Here you have the K delta Z minus omega T, which most people, it's a plane wave pulse. And that's what we're going to look at primarily in this talk, are plane wave pulses. You can do it for a beam field, but it gets more complicated. And the way you do it, you rewrite this exponential in this form for asymptotic analysis, because what you want to do is you want to look as delta z gets big. This phase function phi is I c over delta z k tilde delta z minus omega t. And we write that as I omega n of omega minus theta, where theta is this ct over delta z. And we call that a space-time parameter. So for theta less than 1, that's superluminal. theta greater than 1, that's subluminal, theta equals 1, that's the speed of light point, space-time point. And Sommerfeld's theorem, which he did it for a Heaviside step function, but you can generalize it to general fields and also to general, and he also did it for a single resonance Lorentz medium, but you can generalize it to general types of dielectrics as long as they're causal, that if the initial field vanishes for all t less than 0, and if the real part of this phase function goes to negative infinity as omega goes to infinity in the upper half complex plane for all theta less than 1, then you can prove that an extension of Copson's theorem, you can prove that the A of z and t equals 0 for all delta z greater than 0 when theta is less than 1. So you can't get any, you just can't, it's a rigorous proof, it's rigorous, there's no asymptotics, this is just very nice mathematics. And it says that if I have a sharply defined front where I turn on the field, I cannot get anything past that field, at least not in the context of this theory. So, and then what this luminal arrival of the signal front tells you that any information that may be present in a signal will then follow at some later space-time point, theta greater than 1. N of omega, you can, what's been assumed about it, N of omega has to go back here. This quantity, I omega, N of omega minus eta, must go to minus infinity. That's all you've assumed about N of omega, is must satisfy that property as you're going off to negative, off to infinity in the upper half plane. Yeah, well, it has to be analytic. Yes, there is. Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, yeah. Oh, in the upper half plane. Yes, that's already embedded in there. Yes, it has to be. Yes, any poles have to be in the lower half plane. That's already included in there. Yeah. Actually, I should include that in there. I should include that statement in there.
So,
right.
Yep. This is an assumption, right? So this is related to what Peter was discussing last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be unity, actually. There are materials, for example, a Debye-type dielectric doesn't approach unity as you go off to infinity. The real part does, but the imaginary part has some value bigger than unity. And what you then find is at the speed of light point, the front arrival will be at C over some infinite value of n, which may be bigger than 1. Okay, so you can move that front in, not the other way, but you can the Debye model includes that. It can be slower, yeah, yeah. And that's supposedly a causal model, so that's an okay model. Yes, yes, it is. Yes. I don't know of that would be interesting to look at if there are materials when you have this less than one as to what that means, but then. I'd like to take a look. Oh, you mean for n being less than 1? You mean for these double negative materials? And I haven't looked at that yet.
Mr. For those who were not here from last week's session, we had a long discussion about the Barton-Sharnhorn effect in Cassie effect, maybe actually less than 1 at infinite frequency. So that's an example of a violation of the condition for some of
them. Yeah. And I think that needs to be re-looked at. That needs to be looked at again. And just to kind of, there's a nice website that Wolfram Company runs. You can type in a scientist and find pictures of them in their biography, Wolfram Research. And so there's some nice pictures of Arnold Sommerfeld at various stages in his career. Very hard to find a picture of Leon Brillouin. You usually find a picture of his father, Marcel. But this is who's also a very well-known physicist in France, and this is Leon Brillouin, and this is H.A. Lorentz.
Son,
yes. Yes.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Yeah.
No.
Neither did Sommerfeld. Yes, neither did Sommerfeld. Anyhow, so at that time, the phase velocity, if you look in Rayleigh's 1877 paper, phase velocity, he points out, is describes the rate at which the phase fronts of the wave propagate through the dispersive medium. If you dig around, it appears the first place you can find a reference to the group velocity is by Hamilton back in 1839. And if you you know, and these papers are they're awful to read actually, but well, some of them are fun, I guess. But if you look in Born and Wolf, he describes that the group velocity describes the rate at which a group of waves propagates as a whole through the dispersive medium. And then Billy Wan, in his book, talks about the signal velocity, and he makes a very fine distinction between the signal velocity and the group velocity. He says that a group of waves was originally defined by Rayleigh as moving beats, here I'm quoting, following each other in a regular pattern. Okay, so he's looking at this infinite train of moving beats. And then he says that a signal is a short, isolated succession of wavelets with the system at rest before arrival and also after it has passed. And in general, the signal velocity will differ from the group velocity, especially if the phase velocity is strongly frequency dependent. So he really had really describing a lot of what we've been talking about, and if the absorption cannot be ignored. And so what Billy Wan did was, at that time, there was an asymptotic method of steep as a sense that was introduced by Debye, actually. Yes? Well, yeah. Well, just a little pulse, you know, like if you just design a pulse, there's a bunch of little waves underneath an envelope, for example. That would be, I think that's. Well, I'll show you. I'm quoting Billy Wan. But what you do is you look at these canonical problems. Here's a simple wave group that if you look in Born and Wolf, you see this picture. You take two different wavelengths, you superimpose them, and you get these beats. And the peak, the envelope of these beats, the oscillations underneath travel at the phase velocity, but the envelope travels with the group velocity. Okay, and that's really what the group velocity means. So the group velocity is a physically valid velocity measure when it's used in connection with that original structure that it was introduced, this wave group. Okay, and in that case, it describes, you can take a peak amplitude, you can take a zero point, but it describes how this envelope propagates in this infinite group. But when you try to extend this, this concept of group velocity to a very short optical pulse, for example, then you start to come into, and it doesn't, for this infinite group, it doesn't bother me that this envelope is going to go superluminally or negatively. It doesn't make any difference at all because there really isn't any information associated with that. But when you start to try to apply this group velocity to a pulse, a short pulse, that's when difficulties arise. And I'll show you that in the canonical theory. If you look at specific pulses and ask the question, what's going on, the group velocity I found to be very misleading. And what Billy Wan, and I think Billy Wan thought it was misleading also, that's why he introduced this concept of a signal velocity. But unfortunately, he based this definition of signal velocity on this method of steepest descent. And what he did, this, again, these are pictures directly from his book. Here's the reference to Debye's paper, which is back in 1909 on the method of steepest descent. He deformed his contour of integration, and I will explain what these figures look like, where these figures come from, but there's a saddle point here, and there's another saddle point out here, and the steepest descent path through both of those saddle, sorry, the other saddle points out here, the steepest descent path happens to cross through this branch cut where the resonances are located, basically, in the lower half plane. And he associated the signal arrival with when this steepest descent path crossed the pole. And that turns out to be wrong. That's actually wrong. And so he ended up with a wrong answer, but he had the right idea. It turns out that when that path crosses the pole is irrelevant in the asymptotic analysis because if it crosses the pole, the steepest descent path is asymptotically negligible to the contribution to the saddle point. And so in the asymptotic analysis, it's not the big contribution, and so it shouldn't be considered. And so that's not a good thing to define the signal velocity, and in fact, there's another picture, is the inverse velocities. The blue curve is phase. The red curve is the inverse of the group velocity. And the green curve is the signal velocity, according to Billy Wan. And you notice that because that steepest descent path has to go to the branch cut, okay, for the complex inverse for refraction of the Lorentz medium, frequencies near resonance will be picked up near the speed of light. So you get this peaking of the signal velocity to the speed of light near resonance, which isn't correct. But that's all Billy Wan had to work with at that time. And so they just put a lot of emphasis on this steepest ascent path. This was partially corrected by Bearwald in a paper in 1930. And here's this peak, and this again is inverse signal velocity. Bearwald showed it should be a minimum, not a maximum. And these again are inverse signal velocities. And the techniques that we've used, there's a very beautiful paper published in 1970 by Alver. Alver is a very well-known applied mathematician at Maryland, and he published his beautiful paper in SIAM called Why Steepest Descents. And he showed that the path of steepest ascent was a red herring in the analysis. It does not have the significance that people attribute it to. In fact, he proves, his theorem, Alver's theorem, proves that the asymptotic expansion is independent of the path you take as long as you're in a region below this that has more attenuation than the saddle point. We call that an Alver-type path. And so what George and I did was we reworked all of this stuff using that. Now, using that technique, and I'm going to try to get to that quickly. I just did want to point out Alver, 1970 SIAM review. It's in SIAM review 1970. He also has a book. He has this beautiful book on asymptotics and special functions. Olver. Yeah, you have to be, there's, yeah. It's F W J Alver. Yeah, his son is also an applied, he also has a son who's an applied mathematician, I think, is up in Colorado or somewhere. So there are two Alvers floating around, but there's a book he's published which is called Asymptotics and Special Functions, but really his paper really is the best place to look. So that was one part of the problem, was defining the signal velocity. When I was George's student, George said there must be something wrong in Brillouin's Wan's analysis, and we found Alver's paper, and we found out right away that Brillouin had misidentified the signal velocity. But it wasn't his fault. Again, it was the state of applied mathematics at that time. Okay. The other thing that Brillouin wanted to do was also find the energy velocity, and for that he used the Lorentz model dielectric. And I just wanted to point out that there is this paper by Barash and Ginzburg. In Soviet physics back in 1976, where he looks at Poynting's theorem, and I love this quote from Stratton that in discussing Poynting's theorem that a theory is not an absolute truth but a self-consistent analytic formulation of the relations. So Poynting's theorem is a self-consistent formulation. But whether there's absolute truth or whether there's real energy we're talking about or not is always subject to interpretation. Sure. Yes. Mm-hmm.
How does this differ from Brillouin's definition of energy velocity?
What this just does, this proof just shows that if you go through the proof, and I can do this later on if people are interested. But you can go through and show that you cannot, in general, when you do this, if you don't have a model for the dielectric, you can't say this is loss and this is what's propagating. I understand what you're saying, but that's what Barash and Ginzburg proof shows is that if you try to do this from general principles, you cannot. Okay, and I understand that you have some kind of constructive approach that says that you can do that.
Basically, what we discovered is that this is just the wrong way to do it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But I'd like to see, I would challenge you, I would like to see a specific example where you actually do it.
What's wrong with it?
No, he says, let's look at this kind of, Taylor expansion or something of the chi.
This right here.
Let's look at these this way. And let's try to look at the various quadratic forms that come up in the energy, and let's try to identify some of these quadratic forms. And the point is that you don't get pieces which are clearly positive definite, plus time derivatives of objects that are clearly purely positive definite, and therefore throw your hands up and you say, you can't make it such a leap. But the whole point is that this is not the thing to do.
What's wrong with it?
Just do the Taylor series.
What's wrong with it?
Because it doesn't allow you to immediately see what is what you want to do is you want to look at, you want to look at the at E times, or D times E dot. You want to look at the integral again. And, or just look at D times E dot. And what you want to do is you want to identify quadratic forms which are positive definite together with quadratic forms together with forms which are the time derivative of positive definite forms. And there's a piece of it which looks like that, and then there's all these other pieces that you can't make sense of.
Well, so there's not necessarily anything wrong with it.
There's nothing wrong with this proof. He just...
It leads you down
a dead end. Yeah.
Well, but that's okay. Let me ask my question a different way. Well, okay, so we all agree you can do this mathematically.
Yeah, it's just that it doesn't lead to these obvious forms that you're looking for. Mm-hmm.
The whole idea was to look for forms.
Yeah. This proof is, and I've thought a great deal about your I'm going backwards about your derivation, and I'm trying to resolve that. But I reference this paper. I think it's a very nice paper. It's an approach to doing this problem, and I'd like to see a general way of doing this in a specific example.
So there may be issues with convergence, but what I'm saying is even if there is an issue with convergence, even if that Taylor series makes sense, it doesn't lead you to the thing that you're looking for. The thing that you're looking for, I mean, kind of the idea here was that you're hoping that you would see what you're about to see right here. Look at E times P dot. And look what you have. You have the time derivative of a positive definite form, which is actually the first and third term, uh-huh. And that gives you the free energy. And then you have this just positive definite form, which gives you E. So in the case of Lorentz oscillator, you see those forms.
Yep.
So you think, maybe if I do the Taylor series, I'll see them in a very general case.
And you don't.
And you don't.
And you don't. I think that's the proof, is that you don't. And that is what Barash and Ginsburg show, is that you don't. And then their question is...
What we call this free energy here, we call it the point free energy. You point at it and you say, it looks like the right thing. And so in this other approach, you don't get to see the point free energy. You point to...
Yeah. So anyhow, but if you go through for a Lorentz model, you can identify unambiguously what this quantity is, and once you've done that, you can then define this thing called the energy transport velocity, which is something that really Juan originally looked at, and it wasn't really correctly done until Rodney Loudon published his paper in 1970, where he found the correct point to energy. And identified it, and then my student Xupin Shen generalized this to a multiple resonance material. And so really, what you do is you look at these. You look at a multiple resonance Lorentz model dielectric. And you put a time harmonic field on it. These are not pulsed fields. These are time harmonic fields. Loudon's definition is for a time harmonic field. You can identify these quantities. You can identify the energy stored in the field. And there's this cute little identity between the square of the real minus the square of the imaginary part, which is just epsilon r, just turns out to be epsilon r, the relative epsilon r, the real part of the dielectric permittivity. And if you use that, this little identity, you can get the total time average electronic energy density in this form, where the sum extends all over all of the medium resonances. And then you take the pointing vector and you divide that by U and you come up with this expression. And that's the ratio of this point, a time average pointing vector to the time average energy density stored in the field in the medium, this collection of Lorentz oscillators.
This is assuming only absorbers,
supposing
you have inverted media.
I'm only going to be looking at absorbers. I don't know the answer for inverted media.
But again, Kurt, this energy that you have in the denominator here is just the sum of sort of the kinetic energy and potential energy of the oscillator.
Mm-hmm.
Again, always overestimate the ability of the medium to do work, except in the case of a single Lorentz model.
I hear you saying that, but I don't believe that, because when I go in here and use this expression and I look at signal velocities, I get very close correlation. I understand what you're saying, but this...
I'm not talking about velocity.
Yeah.
Like SOV,
yeah.
I'm just saying that thing in the denominator completely overestimates the ability of the system to sort of organize itself and do something.
Well, yeah, we can talk ad infinitum about that. I disagree with that. I think this velocity turns out to be very, very useful for describing pulse propagation.
Is this a real velocity ascribed to something actually moving? For me, it means what velocity would this energy we're looking at need to be moving in order to accomplish F? Does that make any sense?
Well, I will show you. Okay, but I will show you that. So here is this velocity that we have for a monochromatic field. I will show you that in the pulse case, this velocity has tremendous physical interpretation.
You also point out in two and one of the experimental cases, they point out that their measured velocities disagree with the
pulse. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, but Chu and Wang also, we had published a paper earlier that Chu and Wang, I mean, it was a paper that George and I published, where we used this velocity, okay, and the attenuation in the Lorentz oscillator material, and we're able to use those two quantities and reconstruct exactly the response of the material to a delta function pulse. Okay, so, and that's what Chu and Wang disagreed with. I mean, so we have this picture of a delta function pulse, which is completely causal, and Chu and Wang said, well, that can't be because here's my Gaussian pulse, but we did it for a delta, we were looking at a delta function pulse. And that's where the confusion came into my mind is that we were able to show that doing these types of things at a delta function, we get a very causal definition for what the pulse looks like for a delta function pulse. And there was nothing wrong mathematically with that.
That's not what I understand now.
Well, the delta function, but you can always construct pulses with the impulse response. So if the delta function pulse is causal, other pulses should be too. Anyhow. So here is this energy transfer velocity, and we've done it for two different cases, and you can see that you get minima in this energy transport velocity at the resonance frequencies of the Lorentz oscillators, or these two Lorentz oscillators, and in between you get a peak. And depending upon the parameters, there's a theorem that Chupin and I worked up. You can show that if this peak is greater than the zero value of this energy velocity, you will introduce a new precursor field into the pulse evolution. If it's not, in this case, for example, there wouldn't be a precursor field. And I will return to that later on. So this turns out to be a very useful type of measure. Okay, now getting into the actual pulse propagation. I mean, so these are kind of like monochromatic backgrounds. These things have all been done for, you know, almost monochromatic fields. The question we really want to answer is, what is the signal velocity, which is a good question, and what does a pulse do? So here is the Fourier-Laplace integral representation of a propagated plane wave pulse. Okay, this psi function is introduced. We can either go from a sine wave or a cosine wave carrier. This amplitude, the spectral amplitude, satisfies Helmholtz equation. And this is my initial pulse envelope, and here's my complex wave number. That's that. And if you look at a single resonance Lorentz model, here I have the real part and the imaginary part, and it's a causal material. This is a causal model. It has undamped resonance frequency omega naught and damping constant delta naught, and this plasma frequency b naught. And you can see the region of anomalous dispersion here is defined between these two frequencies, basically. And if you look at a double resonance Lorentz model dielectric, you get this type of behavior. And there's a minimum in the absorption at this point, and there's a turning point at that point. There's a
At this state, would it be possible to just make a quick guess, or would it be really tricky to guess what would happen if you simply change the eyes?
Oh, that's really tricky. That really is tricky. I've partially investigated that a few times, and it gets very difficult. And it's something I have to do at some point in time. But
But
it would make it into a gain amp, some type of gain amplifier, non-saturable gain amplifier, for example.
It's the numerator.
Yes, right. You want to change sign. You're right. If you change that sign, if you change the sign down below, you just get a messy answer, because all your sign conventions, if you change a sign inconsistently with all the other eyes changing in your analysis, nothing changes. But if you just change that sign, you get superluminal results, because that's right. And you can get any result that you want in that case. It gets very strange looking. That's right.
Your comment is too restricted to a two-level medium, in my view, of what you say to change the memory. But keep in mind, you're just thinking about that one thing.
No, but we're talking about a Lorentz model, okay? At the two-level model, when you map it onto the Lorentz model, what happens when you break the medium and you change the memory?
Yeah.
Keep in mind that you're talking about a two-level medium.
Causality is a general feature, so you can never produce poles on the upper.
Yeah, that's right. And if you flip that, that's right. That's right.
Hmm?
I agree. Oop. That's a good point. I understand what you're saying, but yeah. Okay. Now, for a long time, the group velocity description has been around, which I've always, and we have undulationalists and corpusculists, and I have group. There's a I think group people who like the group velocity, they have a little cult going here. But Emil was pointing out to me that this quasi-monochromatic or slowly varying envelope approximation was originally introduced in the context of partial coherence theory, and was borrowed by these group velocities. Group velocityists. So what they're saying is that the initial pulse envelope, if this is sharply peaked about the pulse carrier frequency, what you want to do to analyze that integral is you want to expand around this point omega sub c where it's peaked. And so what they do is they do all their expansions around this point, and it turns out that as the pulse propagates, of course, that's just not the right point.
This remark by Emil, if he didn't introduce the quasi-monochromatic, discounted. This is a simple-minded thing. Yeah. Warren would want to be associated with the
key invented. Yeah, but I think using this approach, this quasi-monochromatic approach, and doing these expansions, I think, is, well, I'll talk to Emil about that again. I'll see what he says. But anyhow, what you do is, and you all know this, if you just use a linear approximation, you come up with the fact that the pulse envelope propagates undistorted in shape with the group velocity. We've all seen that. If you look at the quadratic dispersion approximation and you introduce this other term, which is called group velocity dispersion, you end up with this form for the propagated field, which looks very much like a Fresnel diffraction integral. And so, in fact, there's a paper by Jones in the American Journal of Physics back in 74 where he introduces this pulse width parameter, which is akin to, it's equivalent to the principal Fresnel zone in the analogous diffraction problem. And so you can show that you either have Fraunhofer diffraction or Fresnel diffraction, depending upon whether your pulse is bigger or how many T sub Fs there are in your initial pulse width. And it's a very nice paper by Jones. And what Jones was doing was following up on a lot of work that Robert Bruce Lindsay was doing at Brown University on pulses on strings, on loaded strings. He was doing a lot of work on that, and Jones generalized his work to that. I kind of repeat myself here again. I don't know why I kept these other slides in here. But what you see is that if you if you start to look at these approximations, these quadratic approximations to the real dispersion curves, and the solid curve is the real beta of omega, the real part of k tilde of omega, and the dashed curve is the actual behavior of alpha of omega for this single resonance Lorentz model dielectric. And beta 1 and usually what people do is they approximate to beta. They kind of forget the absorption. They kind of leave that alone. But if you do that linear approximation to beta 1, you get this blue curve, which is not very good. If you do a quadratic approximation, you get beta 2. Gets a little bit better locally, perhaps. I'll get into what happens as you include more terms, okay? But anyhow, if you look at this energy transport velocity that Loudon has for this Lorentz medium, you have this the green curve is the phase velocity, the blue curve is the group velocity when it's positive. There's a negative branch down here which I didn't want to plot. And the purple curve is this energy transport velocity to Loudon. And you can see that it's everywhere subluminal. Okay, and if you look at this quadratic dispersion approximation, for a double resonance material, if you do it for both the real wave number and the imaginary part of the wave number, the red curve is when the carrier frequency is at the inflection point in the real index of refraction. It doesn't do a very good job of describing the absorption, and it really doesn't. It does an okay job, but it's the errors are significant.
Why are you showing us these
two approximations? Why am I showing them to you? Just to show you that they don't work. To show you that they don't work. If you look at the spectrum, for example, why you don't? I'm trying to argue that you don't want to do these stupid approximations because they are stupid. Because if you look at the spectrum due to an input pulse into this Lorentz model dielectric, the peak starts here, and the green curves are at increasing propagation distances into the material relative to the absorption depth of that frequency. And you see that the point that you'd expand around, this carrier frequency here, the peak has really shifted to lower frequency. So you're right away, you're off on that peak. And also, you have these additional structures which are not doing a very good job. The dotted curves are what the quasi-monochromatic approximation give you. You can see it even better if you look at a single cycle pulse in this Lorentz model dielectric. The solid curve is as best as you can get a numerical integration of that using a million points. And the dotted curve is what you get using the group velocity, the quadratic dispersion approximation and the group velocity approximation. And you can see that at half an absorption depth, there's differences at the leading and trailing edges. It's relative to the carrier frequency of the pulse. Okay, so this would be. Well, if I'm going through a material that at that carrier frequency the absorption depth is a kilometer, then this would be at a half a kilometer. Okay.
But I think a communication fiber.
Okay.
What is the actual absorption depth?
It may be many, many, many kilometers, yeah, at some carrier frequency, right?
If you're measuring gamma over.
Well, what I'm doing is I'm saying I have a material and it has an absorption depth of so many meters, and all I'm doing is propagating it fractions of that distance and looking at where the group velocity approximation starts to break down.
How broad is the spectrum?
The pulse between the two resonance lines. If you go into the paper that Hong and I published, if you look at the two absorption lines, the pulse spectrum is 99.99% of the energy is contained between those two resonance lines. So so even though it's a very short pulse, the spectrum still is contained within those two resonance lines. Yeah. So the group velocity approximation hangs together up to about a half an absorption depth is the point. And as you start to exceed that, what happens is it starts to break down. In the dotted curve, you can see as I go from 1 to 5 to 10 to 20 absorption depths in the material, I get the group velocity question gives me the completely wrong answer. And the reason it's giving me the wrong answer is because I start to get these precursor fields, and it does not describe these precursor fields, because the precursor fields occur from spectral regions either way below where I'm expanding or way above where I'm expanding. And even, but now I'll even be a little even more. It turns out that there's a little Sommerfeld precursor way off to the left here. This is a Brillouin precursor actually right here. This field right here is actually a middle precursor field, which occurs between the two resonance lines, and it does not appear too far off from omega sub c. But you can see that the group velocity approximation is trying to describe this middle precursor field, but is not doing it very well. You can see that better if you look at this is a 39 femtosecond rectangular envelope pulse, and we're looking at a quadratic dispersion approximation and a cubic dispersion approximation by including an additional term, and you can see that it's misrepresenting the leading edge. Here it gets the leading edge a little bit better, but then it completely destroys the second peak in the pulse, and it's not really getting this tailing behavior in the pulse at all. And this is at 3 absorption depths in the material, and so. I mean, the argument that I've seen in the literature, there's all these arguments that people keep on saying that what you want to do, you want to include higher order terms in this expansion. And that's what they say. If you don't have the accuracy that you want to include higher order terms, and there's a whole bunch of places. See, it says naturally the higher order approximations make the picture, the quantitative picture, more precise.
Now, Garrett and McCumber, in their papers, they pointed out that around the resonance, there are these poles. Mm.
Yeah, sure. I understand. That's right. Yeah, and that's what we found. Yeah,
yeah. Matter.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And so what we are looking at, but in spite of all of that, they're saying, well, if my pulse is away from there, then we can keep on including these terms, and it just doesn't work. And so, so we actually went out. We as you include the number, if you increase the number of terms, you can see that the 10-term approximation is actually worse than the 3-term approximation. It just gets worse. And we're, you know, we've picked the point that's at the inflection point in between these, so it's kind of as far removed from those two resonances as we can. And you're right, it's because that you cannot go any further than that.
Can you go back to the student
trial? Sure.
Oop. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it'll be on the website. Yeah. But
I asked this question to you before.
Yeah. No.
It all applies to each other. It all depends on the distance between the resonance lines.
Yeah.
But in fact, you took the resonance line so far apart, mm-hmm. you have to go to a really broad bandwidth.
Yeah.
Where you first have the
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Close,
yeah.
And then
immediately yeah.
have a breakdown of the series
mm-hmm.
expansion
yeah.
without ever having to go to all
yes.
the
I agree with you. Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. And one of our arguments we have, if you look at our paper, we have these arguments about the spectral width of the pulse relative to the distance between these two resonance lines.
Right. It's just
yeah.
Because you're treating real glass.
Yeah.
With those lines
yeah.
Apart,
yeah.
Apart,
yeah. Understand. But again, if you go in my paper, you'll see that we talk about that spectral width. And I think looking at those very close cases may be the way to do the experiments, perhaps. So anyhow, as far as initial conclusions, which gives me, I think, 10 minutes to finish up the rest of my talk, if you're really going to look at the velocity of an ultra-wideband pulse in a dispersive material, you really must give careful consideration to the material dispersion. And that means including the attenuation. You really have to be very careful how you approximate the attenuation. Dispersive pulse propagation has two pieces to it when you're in a material. There's phase dispersion, which is very important, and that's an interference effect, but there's also absorption, dispersive absorption. And so you may say, oh, here's two components that are going to interfere with each other, but if one component is being absorbed stronger than the other, you'll reach a regime where that's immaterial at that point in time. And so you have to be careful how you do that. And the way around that is to use saddle point methods. Stationary phase approximations just don't apply. We are also able to show that the group velocity approximations, it seems to work in the small propagation distance as delta z equals to zero. So if you're in a communication system where your absorption depth is 100 kilometers, okay, then you can use the group velocity approximation to halfway of that distance or something, you know, and be kind of safe as to what you're doing. I don't know if those errors accumulate. That's not something I've looked at. Also, if you're going to look at pulse dynamics, especially velocity measures, I really think you have to be very careful. You have to include in the absorption very carefully in the model to understand what's going on. And to do that, you need to do asymptotics. But here's a brief poem I had just to kind of at the halfway mark, which is really at the 90% mark. So anyhow, it's about, you can read it. Yes, he does. He really liked it, actually. And those of you who don't know him won't get it, but those of you who do, when I first met him, I was scared to death of him because he would ask such good questions sometimes. Okay, so the question becomes, there's these slowly varying envelopes, and there's these ultra-wideband signals, and there's these ultra-short pulses, and I've gotten frustrated with first ultra-wideband meant one thing, and then I go to another conference and they get up and they say ultra-wideband is something else now. So what I was saying was ultra-wideband isn't ultra-wide. I just said, I threw up. And it's just like it reminds me of the days of high-power lasers, where every 2 weeks they'd redefine beam quality. DARPA would come out with a new definition of what they meant by beam quality. And the physics hasn't changed, but what you call things change. So they're slowly varying and rapidly varying, and I'm going to talk about rapidly varying pulses. And the point is that I can create these. I don't need to have a step function pulse to make these precursor fields. I just need to change something in the envelope of the pulse very rapidly, which of course, in my opinion, makes it ultra wideband again. But that word is. Yeah, right. That's good. But you can kind of come up with a condition that if the change in slope is faster than the relaxation time in the material, then you can call that rapidly varying. And that's kind of where I want to go. And the reason for that is that if you look at different materials, for example, if you look at a microwave pulse, if you're looking at water, you can get a precursor field easily by having a sub-nanosecond rise time in the front of the pulse. Optically, that's very slow, but at the microwave range with water, that's very fast. Okay, so it really depends upon the how fast you change the envelope in the field relative to some relaxation time of the material. And if you're faster than that, you'll excite these precursor fields. Okay, now the asymptotic description. Basically, we use this phase function phi of omega. We write it as I omega n of omega minus theta. We re-express this in terms of z over c. The saddle points are given by the points where phi prime vanishes. That gives you a general saddle point equation, which is given here. And you can see that these saddle points are a function of the space-time parameter theta, ct over delta z. So if you fix your observation distance, as time varies, these saddle points move around in a complex frequency plane. And they're the points where you want to expand around. And in general, they're very different from omega sub c. In fact, if you look, these saddle points have nothing to do with omega sub c. They have to deal with the medium. If you do this for a multiple resonance material, you'll find you'll get this thing called a first forerunner. We call it a Sommerfeld precursor. There's a Brillouin precursor due to the low frequency response. There will be middle precursors when that condition is satisfied that I quoted before, and I'll get back to that again. And you also have pole contributions, and it's these pole contributions which you identify with the signal velocity. What are these? I'm always asked the question, is there a physical significance to these saddle points? Well, here's the phase function phi. If we differentiate that with respect to omega, we differentiate this expression, k tilde z minus omega t, so we get partial k tilde with respect to omega. This vanishes at the saddle points, okay? And so if we solve that for z over t, we get a group velocity evaluated at the saddle points. And since z over t is real, okay, then if I have this material, the group velocity is real valued at the saddle points of the complex phase function. And in fact, except at the origin and at infinity, they're the only points in the complex frequency plane where the group velocity is real valued and takes on, I guess, physical significance. The trouble is the group velocity is real valued at a complex frequency in general. So it's kind of an interesting result. Just to remind you about power series and asymptotic expansions, I'm sure you all remember this from mathematical methods. With a power series, you get better you fix z and you increase the number of terms to get better accuracy. With an asymptotic approximation, you fix the number of terms and increase Z to get a better approximation. Yeah? Go back one slide.
That's internal part.
Yes.
Where you look out the
equivalent. Yes.
You apply my method for fixing it. And I remember you just said that the
if you look at asymptotics, if you have absorption, the method of steepest ascent replaces the method of stationary phase. You cannot use stationary phase techniques when there is absorption of material. But I do agree with your statement. If you find these settle points in the complex frequency plane, okay, if here is a saddle point. Here is a saddle point, and this is the steepest, and here's the region where I get exponential attenuation. Right on this, if I do my expansion along this line, the transition between amplification and attenuation, okay, I get stationary phase approximation. But if you look at Oliver's method, when he proves this is an asymptotic expansion, works right up to that point. Okay, works, you know, as close as you can, but you cannot get onto that line rigorously. Now, if you talk to people who do asymptotics, if you do the expansion, and I've talked to Jakob Stamnitz a great deal about this, if you do the expansion along that line, you get the same result. Okay, and so the question is, well, maybe I can do that. But if you look at the theorems very carefully, it says that you cannot. But even though they give the same result.
Of course, no reason here is very.
They're similar, yes, but. Well, you may say that you can, but if you look at, you're violating these theorems that applied mathematicians have been very careful to work out, and they're saying that you shouldn't.
So Kurt, is it not, it's the case that if you do this method of stationary phase, you get different answers?
No, you get the same answer.
You get the same answer.
Yeah, you get functionally the same answer, but the interpretation of how you're doing it is different. And you know, if you do this stationary, but you have to find the saddle points, okay? If you find the saddle points, it turns out that, see, what becomes dangerous is that sometimes people will do asymptotics, they'll start going into the regimes where the theorem really starts to break down, and you can come up with very strange results, and then you have to be very careful. Yes, but the theorem, if you look at it, for example, go into Oliver's paper, look at the theorem breaks down as you go into this point. Oliver, I think, does point out that you do get stationary phase on these lines, but the theorem does not apply on those lines. The theorem is about doing an asymptotic expansion. You cannot do, if you look at this, if you have an integral and there's attenuation in an integral, stationary phase does not apply. That's the first thing that you know, you have to go to a saddle point technique. The theorem, you can't work out a mathematical proof that the thing is asymptotic. That's you cannot work out an asymptotic proof.
It works, but it may or may not work.
It may or may not work. And that's right. You cannot prove, you know, so you're getting out of this domain where you have this improvement as Z increases. You don't know if you're there. It may or it may not.
So it's kind of like looking at higher terms.
Yeah, something like that. And you have to be very careful. Asymptotics, very famous Norwegian mathematician by the name of Abel, he got bit by the same thing because he was using them in a slightly way that maybe it looked right, but he got wrong answers. And he claimed they're the invention of the devil. So you have to be very, very careful.
You know there's this method of resumming divergence.
Yes, yeah. But anyhow, there's a picture. If you go to Oslo, there's a statue right here's the Royal Palace over here, and obviously I was there. This is spring in Norway, and there's a statue of Abel wrestling with a sea serpent. They like sea serpents in Norway, and the claim is that he was such an accomplished mathematician there was nothing that could defeat him, and so he's beating the sea serpent. It's quite a nice statue, actually. And I'm always warned not to go up there because that's where the drug dealers are and stuff, right? You know, it's a great place to sell drugs. It's near the capital. So people are always saying, oh, you shouldn't go up there at nighttime or when it's dark. But it's a beautiful statue, and I've never been bothered by anybody in Norway, so it's a very safe place. So what do the asymptotics say? I'm gonna finish this up and skip. These are some slides of these how these saddle points behave. But if you look at the distance saddle points, here are the distance saddle points. If I do my uniform asymptotic expansion around that, and I use a uniform asymptotic expansion, it's due to Handelsman and Bleistein. It's valid, it's uniformly valid as the saddle points come in from infinity. The regular saddle point methods don't work then. You get this beautiful thing, it's called the Sommerfeld precursor. It's in terms of Bessel functions, the expansion. You can look in my papers and look at those expansions. If I look at the near saddle point dynamics, I get these near saddle points that move down. They coalesce into the Mitsubishi symbol, and then they move off into the complex frequency plane, and I get this thing called the Brillouin precursor. And what's beautiful about the Brillouin precursor is that at the point where this upper saddle point crosses the origin, there's no attenuation in an asymptotic expansion. The field does not attenuate exponentially. And so this peak point in the field only decays algebraically. It decays as 1 over the square root of z. Okay, so this field, you know, unlike that picture that Sommerfeld and Brillouin showed of these little squiggly fields, these precursor fields being very small, these precursor fields dominate the field. They define what's going on in the field. And then the final thing is this pole contribution. If I have a step function pulse, I'll have a pole somewhere along the real axis. And I've drawn a case here, is actually from my thesis, before Photoshop and all that kind of stuff. This is hand-drawn. Here's a near saddle point. The near saddle point is dominant over the distant saddle point. And if my carrier frequency is at this point right here, I would say, according to Alvar's method, I can choose any path in this shaded region. Okay? And so if I have a pole there, I have to cross the pole when I deform from my original contour to my deformed contour. I have to cross the pole, and that's what we define as the signal arrival. Then after all theta, for theta after that, that pole contribution is asymptotically dominant over the saddle points. And if you do that, you get this type of a behavior. If I have a below resonance Heaviside step function, like I said, this is a canonical theory. You can either look in my book or in the paper we published back in 88 on this. If you're below resonance, I get a Sommerfeld precursor. There's no field superluminally. I get the Sommerfeld precursor, and I get this big Brillouin precursor, and I get the main signal. And here is my pole. This is my signal arrival is at this point we call theta sub c. And it's not a, people argue, there's a rise in the field, and there's a half amplitude point. There's no rise in the field. There's a drop in the field amplitude. The field amplitude is dropping from the Brillouin precursor to the signal value. And I can determine that experimentally. I've done a numerical experiment. I can determine that experimentally by asking the question, so this Brillouin precursor chirps up in frequency. I ask the question, when does the frequency go to omega sub c? Yeah? Well, I put in a unit amplitude pulse. Okay, a unit amplitude. Yeah, and this is down to 0.15 at you can see the main signal. The main signal has been decayed down to 0.01, for example, so on many absorption depths into the material. Yeah, so it persists very nicely. It really decays very slowly. I don't know. Oh, I don't know the answer. I have not done any inverted media. Okay. Yeah. Richard Albanese has done a perturbation analysis on a nonlinear material with this type of field, and he's found that the precursors are amplified. So they get worse in the nonlinear case. Okay. If I look at the instantaneous frequency, basically it starts off quasi-static, and it approaches the carrier frequency omega naught from below. The Sommerfeld starts off, Sommerfeld precursor starts off at infinite frequency and approaches the upper edge of the absorption band. The Brillouin goes the other way.
So
but
aren't these two precursors just what are named after you eat a big hole out of your
spectrum? Yeah, that's a very simplistic view of looking. You can, like I said, you can construct the precursor fields from that argument, except for one piece. I cannot get the leading edge of this precursor field does not come from real frequencies. It comes from imaginary frequencies, which puzzled George and I to no end. But you can get most of the stuff by arguing it's this eating out. You can get the general picture. But the details, there's something more going on there than just this. There's not only eating out, but there's also phasing. And you have to put that phasing in there also. And that's that really, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, yes. And you got to phase them properly, and then you'll get the frequency. Yep.
The reason why I was saying for a game, you know, is being specific for the two games line. Yeah. And what you're saying is absorbers are left with two peaks that are out here.
Yep.
Norway in the center. In an amplifier, once you travel very deep,
yep.
What happens is the original spectrum now just looks like the amplifier. So you've got two large peaks that come out. So I think what happens is that when you go through the amplifier, we've got a game the other way.
Oh, this point right here? This one? No, this one. This one right here? Yeah, this is. There's actually a transition between when the Sommerfeld precursor is dominant and the Brillouin precursor is dominant.
Yeah.
Oh, it's theta SB. It's a characteristic frequency in the material. It's called theta SB. It's where there's a transition between dominance in the near saddle points and the distant saddle points.
Is that related to the plasma frequency?
No. No.
What is theta SB?
It's just an asymptotic parameter. It describes this transition. It's just an asymptotic parameter. I can express it. I have an analytic expression in terms of the material, but it has no physical simple interpretation in terms of anything, not that I can think of. Yes, I can. Oh, this point here, yes. This is N of zero.
Yeah.
So the peak in the Brillouin precursor travels at C over N of zero. The peak in the Sommerfeld precursor travels at C over a number of 1.01. You know, and that changes. Actually, as you go further and further, that shifts more and more towards one. Okay? This transition point is just an asymptotic parameter in the problem. In fact, you can see that if I go back to this value right here. Here it is right here. This is that value, theta SB. And again, these are hand-drawn from my thing. So here's a near saddle point, and there's a distant saddle point, and they have equal attenuation. There's equal attenuation between them. And that omega SB is the real frequency value of this distant saddle point location. That's what it is, mathematically. And so you can solve for that. I mean, and I have an analytic expression for that, it's in terms of all the Lorentz parameters. It has nothing to do with the pulse, just in terms of the saddle point dynamics. Equal dominance, yes. Their attenuation is the same. Yes. So if I do the asymptotic expansion at this value, I have to expand both about this point and this point. Those are both equally valid points. I have to do both. I have to expand about both. So if I go to a slightly earlier value, 1.25, the distant saddle point dominates the near saddle point. Okay, see, it's inside. It has more attenuation. So I just need to expand around this. So is that saying to me that the Sommerfeld precursor dominates the field evolution? Unless I have a pole out here. If I have a pole out there, it's been crossed, and that dominates everything. Okay, because it has much less exponential attenuation. But if the pole is anywhere in here, then not. And then if I go to a larger value of theta, here's 1.5, a little bit beyond 1.5, the upper near saddle point's dominant, and it's dominating the saddle point. So the Brillouin precursor is dominating the behavior. Sommerfeld precursor is decayed away, and that theta SB point is just an asymptotic transition point between those two behaviors. Well, this is just a single resonance material, so there is not one.
Oh.
This is just single resonance. That's what happens if I have a carrier frequency bigger than that frequency value. If my pole is above that, where that saddle point, where the two saddle points change dominance, if my frequency is higher than that, very strange behavior happens. I get a very strong. And by the way, these are actually numerical results. I'm not just labeling them according to what the asymptotics tell me to do. But if you look at my thesis, I actually drew these by hand back in 77. So, you know, just looking in the asymptotics, you can just kind of sketch out what they're doing. So I was very pleased. So this is at a carrier frequency that's higher than this omega SB value, which is the real saddle point value, the distant saddle point value, at theta SB. And what happens is you get a very strong Sommerfeld precursor. You pick up the pole at this value, okay? But at this later value, the Brillouin precursor becomes dominant. And in fact, if you look at that curve of dominance, that sweeps back out to out to positive infinity again. So the pole, it's not subtracted, it just becomes less dominant. And so you see the Brillouin precursor with this pole contribution on top of it. And then finally, after some much later value, the main signal arrives. So you get this. You get this region where the Sommerfeld precursor dominates. You get another little region where the pole dominates, where it's oscillating at omega sub c. You get a region where you've got a Brillouin precursor, and the pole is on top of it. And then finally, you get a region where it's basically just the main signal.
Now, this 0.01, which is roughly the amplitude of 0.08.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The amplitude of the main signal.
Yeah.
That's what now? That's e to the minus 5.
Yeah, absorption depths. Yeah.
E to the minus 5 of 1.
Yeah, right. I start with the 1, yes. Yes.
And this shows that the precursors are not being attenuated at that same exponential rate.
That's right.
The main pulse.
That's right.
Because they're associated with the spectrum.
Alpha. And so the whole idea is, of course, you look at this, you look at this Brillouin precursor, you say, well, I can use that to probe material, I can get through materials with these Brillouin precursors, and the idea is, you say, well, gee, there's not much amplitude here. But see, I'm exciting these precursors very inefficiently with a step function pulse. That's not the best way. There are optimum pulse shapes to optimize.
Yeah, sure.
So, okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. The absorption is relatively small at this case, yeah. So I'm very far into the material.
But I was going to ask about gamma. How wide is the absorption?
Oh, I see. This is I don't have a drawing for that, but it's yeah, that's a good question. No, I don't. I can go back and look. I have that somewhere else. But this is up in the wings. This is getting up beyond. It's relatively down. But again, this is a very absorptive material. So
your plots are typically for how the omega zero and gamma relate to each other.
Yeah, omega.
Intrinsic
parameters. Yeah,
of
yeah.
How are they related?
Yeah, omega zero is much bigger than gamma. Yeah, omega zero. Actually, I use delta. Omega zero is much bigger than omega zero is 4 × 10⁻¹⁶. Delta, the absorption parameter, is like 0.28 × 10⁻¹⁶. So it's much smaller.
Ten.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. Say that in terms of a Q factor?
But the amazing thing about this is that if I then look at this signal velocity, which is defined by when the pole contribution becomes dominant over the saddle point contributions for this single resonance case, I get these red curves. And I did this came out of my thesis. I get these little red dots. And I had this bifurcation in the curve, because this is the region in between where the Brillouin precursor becomes dominant over the pole contribution, okay? And the solid curve in this diagram is Loudon's energy velocity. And you can see that Loudon's energy velocity forms an upper envelope to these signal velocities. And that's what drove George and I to say that, wow, we could invert Loudon's energy velocity, okay, and use the attenuation of the material. And basically ask the question, if I'm at a certain space-time point in the field, I say to myself, what frequency component can have arrived there with a given energy velocity with the least attenuation? And that is the amplitude and oscillation frequency at that point in time. And by doing that Gedanken construction, we can construct, for example, the behavior of a delta function pulse exactly. Okay, and we've published that in PhysRev letters, and that's what Chu and Wang responded to with their Gaussian pulse experiment, which didn't really have anything to do with what we were doing. And then we published a paper in JOSA B about 15 years later with all the details of that. So you can do that. And you can also do an experimental measure. We propagated pulses experimentally and looked at the frequency of oscillation and measured when did the field settle to the carrier frequency, the input carrier frequency. And we calculated the time of arrival of all those, and we plotted them There's a group of students I was working with at Vermont, and we plotted them, and we got very good agreement with this signal velocity curve. So we were able to reproduce this in a numerical experiment to kind of say that indeed there's something interesting there. And here's that paper that George and I published in JOES of B in 95. So there's this energy velocity, even though it's defined for a monochromatic wave, there's a lot of good physics in there. It does describe something in the field. It describes some energy transport in the dispersive medium for this time harmonic wave. But you can use it to describe the pulse arrivals, signal arrivals in this material. You can go to a multiple resonance material, and here's a multiple resonance material. My student Xu Pin and I looked at this, and also Judy Lawrence later on. Here is this theorem, which I'll kind of, basically it's if this velocity goes above, you get this velocity branch, and the solid curves are again signal velocities determined from asymptotics, from the saddle point dynamics, and the red curve is the multiple resonance energy velocity, and you can see again it still forms an envelope to these curves. We have Pac-Man over here. The dynamics become very complicated. So in this case, there wouldn't be a middle precursor. In this case, there is a middle precursor. And if you look at the delta function responses, Sommerfeld-Brillouin, no middle precursor, Sommerfeld-Brillouin, and there's this middle precursor that appears in there. And if you look at water, here's water. This is data that the Air Force has gotten me. The original, this is Rocard, this is Debye relaxation, and there's a bunch of Lorentz lines. This is the absorption. We did some fitting on that, so we use this model for that. But if you do the impulse response of water, it turns out there's almost a middle precursor. We get a Sommerfeld precursor, we get a Brillouin precursor, but the tail of the Brillouin precursor, there are two saddle points that compete. And so you get this interference, this very slow interference effect. And so that's water. And so there's a very strong Brillouin precursor in water, so if you get a very rapidly pulsed field on your head, and microwave people tell you that it's absorbed within a few centimeters, but if it excites a Brillouin precursor, it's going to go very, very deep, and so you don't want to do that. If you look at a rectangular pulse, it's just a difference between two step function signals, and you get some interesting effects with this. Especially at that above resonance case, you get some very strange effects in this. You actually, this the main signal disappears. The only part that's oscillating in omega sub c is that prepulse. And yep, I'm done. And if you get the if you look at the velocities, because of that, you get a velocity jump. The signal velocity comes up, and at that frequency omega sb, it jumps to the upper branch of the energy velocity curve. So you get this jumping effect. So I will end it there. We also have results for Gaussian pulses and other types of pulses. But each one of these things you can define. The point is that you can define rigorously a signal velocity in many cases. The case that you cannot is the Gaussian pulse. And there's a paper that we published. These are slow in PhysRev letters. But if you look at a Gaussian pulse, there is no pole. And so a Gaussian pulse, the Gaussian pulse breaks into a Sommerfeld precursor and a Brillouin precursor. And I think we saw that in some of the, that's what I was pointing out in one of the earlier talks. You get this breaking up of a Gaussian pulse into a Sommerfeld and a Brillouin. There is no signal velocity for a Gaussian pulse because there's no signal. There's no pole, so I can't identify a signal. And so the only thing you can do is you can look at the peak values, for example. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
So can you summarize how you reconcile this with Garrett and McCumber?
In what sense?
Garrett and McCumber propagated Gaussian mm-hmm. and showed that the group velocity makes sense in that case.
Yeah.
And 201 verified Garrett and McCumber.
Yeah. Oh, going the wrong way. What we did was we looked at the, and I have the, here are these group lines, but I have, here's, if you look at the peak velocity of this Gaussian pulse, okay, when you put in these pulses, the peaks, if you look at a peak of the Gaussian pulse, the peak moves along the group velocity curve. And here is the group velocity curve. And we found that these peaks move right along this group velocity curve. So if you have the pulse for very short times, so you can get superluminal values, you can get negative values, and it's all reshaping. You know, it's all the pulse, a distortion, as you'd say. It's all changing. But they occur only for very, very, very fleeting instance of time. Does that happen? Because as the pulse starts to reshape, its frequency shifts. And as its frequency shifts, it moves out of these superluminal and negative luminal velocity branches very quickly into the normal regions. And so the pulse rapidly redistributes itself into a subluminal velocity. So you may start with a Gaussian pulse, and for a very short period of time, it behaves, quote unquote, superluminally. Its peak is traveling faster than the speed of light, but it reorganizes itself very, very quickly to go subluminal. Okay, and that's what we found when we do these types of calculations using Pietros's, for example, central velocity. We find that for a very brief instance of time, it'll go superluminal, and then it comes back very quickly. And
Yes.
Right.
You really see these.
Yes. 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 You would. Yes, you would. You would see this peak moving. Yes, you would. Yeah.
But they haven't traveled far enough.
Yeah. If you make the medium longer. Yeah. 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 If you make the medium longer, it. Yeah. So I had all these things on pulse velocities, but if you can see that, for example, that's reshaping delay. If you look at this relative central velocity, we found that for both rectangular pulses and Gaussian pulses, this is below resonance. We find that as you let the propagation distance increase, they're bounded by these precursor fields. They go over to these precursor fields, and so the velocity gets set asymptotically by the precursor fields. But initially, you can certainly get. For example, here's a 10-cycle rectangular pulse in the absorption band. You can get these branches. It actually jumps across these branches. But as you go larger and larger, they always settle down to whichever precursor field happens to be dominant. If you're way above resonance, it's the Sommerfeld precursor that begins to set it.
I don't think it's fair to say
it's a myth. Well, it's I have the speed of light point, yes? Okay, I have it in nothing. I can get the pulse to move, to look like it's moving, look like it's virtual. I think it's virtual superluminal because it looks like it's moving faster than the speed of light for a very brief instant of time. But if it was moving faster than the speed of light for a long time, it could overtake the front, and that'll never happen. That will never happen. Yeah. So you can never make that camera like I described. You know, whenever you take up your camera, what you wanted to take the picture, it happened 5 seconds ago. You know, what you don't want is a camera, you push the button. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, but it only occurs for those very, very briefly. It's physical because you're measuring peaks. You're measuring peak values. But the question then becomes, well, what is a peak value? And there's that paper by Diener who says that peak values are not causally related to peak values. Yeah, yeah. So is there information associated with that peak value? I think that's the real question. If they're not causally related to each other, does that mean that there's then no information transmitted? And that's a separate question, right? Well, it's mythical in the sense that you can try to communicate faster than the speed of light. I think that's
well,
that.
Depends on what you mean by communicating.
Yeah, that's the other question. Yeah. They've measured the Air Force has measured the Brillouin precursor in water because it's a good medium to use, and they constructed a huge tank of triply distilled H2O at great expense. A company on the West Coast actually did the experiment. They hired them to do it. Yeah, and they made a microwave burster. There is a paper in JOSA that says experimental observation of optical precursors, and I've read that paper several times, and I can't see the observation in the paper. You know, you read it and read it and read it, and I just don't see it. So, to this date, no. As far as I can tell, there has not. But it has been observed at lower frequencies. Yeah. Yes, Pete.
Perhaps this is
is overly simplistic, but it seems to me that you can make a precursor. If you have a medium with an absorbing resonance, you simply input a pulse that has a spectrum to one side or the other of the resonance, and you're already in precursor.
Broader
than the resonance, then you eat a hole out of it. Yeah. Eventually, the things that are left are the precursors.
Yeah.
But in this case, you could just not excite anything that's going to be absorbed.
I would.
And say, oh, I already have precursors.
I would love to see an experimentalist do this.
Well,
okay, good. Okay, so you have a precursor. Good. Happy to hear that. Well, we could talk. I'd like to see that. I'd like to, you know, yeah. You can figure out if it's a Billy Warren precursor by tracking its peak amplitude decay. And that's how they did that experimentally. When they looked at this pulse decaying through water, okay, they found algebraic decay in the field structure. Okay, yeah.
I was intrigued by the graphs that you showed where you see that the Brillouin precursor doesn't sort of die away and let the signal grow out of it. Mm-hmm. But, of course, there is this chirp because you're going from low frequency to the peak frequency. That made me wonder if you thought about looking not at amplitude modulated signals, but a frequency modulation, and asking when the frequency modulation
That's another canonical problem. And I have these, the Air Force has me stacked up on these. there are lots of canonical problems. Yeah, there are lots of, and you know, it's really great because they keep on, this is the best kind of funding in the world, because every time I ask a little bit, they ask me questions like this. Well, what happens if this happens? What happens if you have a chirp pulse? And chirp pulses are difficult to do. But it's another canonical problem that needs to be addressed. And as long as I can address them slow enough that I die before I answer them all. Right.
Maybe this is a good point to sum up. I have to really urgent questions because we're already 5 minutes past noon. So
yeah. Well, thank you.
I would suggest that.